Who's in charge? Today, Thursday, September 4th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's all crisis all the time on the U.S. foreign policy front right now. We ask what has happened to American leadership in a troubled world. One foreign policy expert says she doesn't even know how President Obama ranks each crisis in order of importance.
He hasn't really spoken to it. He hasn't really taken the time to communicate to Americans his view of what the world on fire means right now.
Also today, why the international response to the Ebola epidemic is so inadequate.
The answer is fear. The head of WHO, Dr. Margaret Chan, she said it's just the fear. There's no medicine for fear.
And later, why residents of Iran's capital, Tehran, have to lead double lives.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. President Obama came into office with a vision of a world at peace, a world where America rebuilt trust with old partners and reached out to old rivals, even old enemies. Obama's vision called for U.S. forces out of Iraq and Afghanistan and a renewed focus on the rising power of China. Well, things didn't quite work out quite as the president envisioned. Today, Obama is at a NATO summit trying to figure out responses to a catalog of unexpected challenges, from Russian aggression in Ukraine to the chaos sweeping so much of the Middle East. To help me get a handle on how the U.S. is doing, I'm joined by Susan Glasser, editor of Politico magazine. So a lot of challenges, Susan. How do you think the U.S. is doing?
Well, it's interesting. The events in the world have a way of rearranging even the biggest grand strategy. And that's why I think Hillary Clinton was the one who liked to talk about you could have whatever plans you had as Secretary of State, but really managing the inbox was the one thing that wasn't optional. And I think President Obama right now is seeing that. We've tried over and over again to put a doctrine label on his foreign policy actions, but in reality, he's left reacting to his inbox. And right now, the inbox is filled with overflowing crises.
Yeah. And as the world's supposed policeman, beacon of democracy, whatever you want to call the United States, do you think the U.S. is punching its weight in foreign policy? Because some in this country on the right say the U.S. is punching well below its weight.
Well, what's striking to me, actually, is that it's really not just people on the right. I've been really struck by conversations over the last few months here in Washington with Democrats as well as Republicans who are openly voicing really significant concerns about what is the role the United States should be playing in the midst of these crises, seeing this as a real test of U.S. leadership, perhaps most acutely in the Middle East. Remember, just a year ago was when President Obama drew a red line in the sand when it came to Syria and its use of chemical weapons. Across the region, there were real ripple effects and a sense of the U.S. really abdicating its leadership role. More broadly, now that spread to questions like what role should we be playing in helping to resolve this basically war between Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, how does the rest of the world perceive U.S. leadership and U.S. power right now in this moment in history?
You know, it's a patchwork, of course. There's no one viewpoint about the United States in the world. But I think there is a broad concern and disaffection even among American friends, or one could say especially among American friends, at a sense that perhaps we're turning away. Perhaps we are really looking inward again in a way that means that the old security arrangements are going to be shaken up.
So apart from the mantra, don't do stupid stuff, do you think he has a vision now?
Well, he's tried to square the circle. Remember, he just very recently actually gave a big foreign policy speech talking about his national security doctrine at West Point. And the link that he was trying to make there was not just don't do stupid stuff, but also to have a broader vision of where we would have sort of targeted, very national interest-focused engagement with the world. I think it's hard to square with the inconsistency with which that doctrine has been applied. Why is it that we opportunistically start to engage in airstrikes in Iraq on behalf in a supposedly humanitarian mission on behalf of the trapped Yazidis, for example, but take so little action that would seem to be of even greater humanitarian crises right next door in Syria.
I mean, with so many crises around the globe, is it clear, do you think, to the White House kind of what the running order of importance of all these crises is?
Well, that's an interesting question, and you haven't heard President Obama talk very much about that. And of course, after last week's press conference that he gave, the famous tan suit press conference, we may not be hearing too much more from him, at least in a press conference setting. He was really beaten up for the slip of the tongue when he said that we don't have a strategy on Syria. I think probably some of that was an unfair interpretation. People seized on it because it resonated, though. There was a sense that, hey, gee, wait a minute, we don't really have a strategy on Syria despite 3 years of civil war and 200,000 people dead. And I think that goes to your question, too. I don't know what President Obama's view of the hierarchy of these crises is because he hasn't really spoken to it. He hasn't really taken the time to communicate to Americans his view of what the world on fire means right now.
Susan Glasser, editor of Politico magazine, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Speaking of Syria, you've seen it, I've seen it, frankly. It's been hard to ignore this summer. I'm talking about the flag flown by the militants in Iraq and Syria who call themselves the Islamic State. It's that black banner with white Arabic writing, the one you see online in images posted by the militants. I was curious about the origins of this banner, so for that I turned to Jonathan Bloom, professor of Islamic art just down the road at Boston College. Let's start, Jonathan, by describing this flag. What does it look like?
Well, it's a black rectangle, and it has two or sometimes three lines of writing in white. The top one says, La ilaha illallah, there is no God with a small g except for God with a capital G. And then in the middle, there's a sort of rough circle that says, Muhammad Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger of God. And then sometimes below, you have a line of much fancier writing that says the state of the Islamic Caliphate, Dawlat Khilafat al-Islamiya.
I mean, it's become so iconic now that the sight of it instills fear. I suppose that's part of the propaganda of this flag.
I think the black color, which I guess we couldn't help as Americans think of as like a pirate flag.
Right. You know? Well, I mean, if you squint your eyes, it almost looks like the Jolly
right,
Roger.
Exactly. But I think, you know, for people who didn't grow up with buccaneers and such things, and certainly in the Islamic world, the black banner of Islam is an idea that goes back to the 8th century when the Abbasid Caliphate, which was the second dynasty of Islam, came to power with black banners.
Mm. So you're going back to the 8th century. That's a long history for this flag.
That's a long history. And, you know, I think even the writing, the style of writing, are in a consciously primitive style of writing that harkens back to the very earliest days of Islam. It's meant to convey ancientness, antiquity. In effect, they're saying, you know, we're going back to this earlier time.
Speaking of graphics, let's talk about that white seal in the middle of this black flag. What are the origins of that seal?
It says Muhammad Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger of God. I think it's meant to evoke the prophet's seal, his signet, though I don't know that anybody knows what the prophet's seal actually looked like. But it's meant to convey this idea of a stone that's a seal.
Hmm. I know Al-Qaeda flies a similar flag, at least to my untrained eye.
Yeah, it uses the shahada, that is the Arabic expression, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah, that is, there is no God but God, Muhammad is the prophet of God, which you find on the Saudi flag too. What's interesting is the black background and the choice of black over and over again, which I think harkens back to this much earlier type. Most of the flags in the Arab world today are red, green, white, and black. And these all go back to the early 20th century and Arab nationalism.
As flags, as a symbol, do you think this is a successful one?
Graphically, yes. Without even knowing a word of Arabic, you can tell what it means. The iconography transcends the semantics of the words.
I mean, it's also interesting, too. I mean, I think of the Nazi swastika and how that was kind of an ancient icon that was reappropriated by the Third Reich.
Right.
This is kind of doing the same thing.
Absolutely. I mean, that if everyone starts identifying their use of this phrase it's sending very much the wrong message if we all accept that this is what that message means. They are co-opting something that has brought millions of people over thousands of years great comfort and solace and meaning in their lives.
Jonathan Bloom is a professor of Islamic art at Boston College. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Cell phone users in Iran got some unexpected good news recently. The government gave the country's two major mobile operators permission to ramp up to 3G and 4G service. Until now, faster networks were not allowed because Iran's conservatives didn't want to make it easier for their opponents to use the internet. I asked New York Times Tehran bureau chief Thomas Erdbrink what the change actually means.
What is happening is that the granting of this license doesn't mean immediately everything will work here on the 3G network in Iran, but it does mean that the two principal mobile phone operators are rolling out these systems and people will be able to go on it. But they still officially, at least, won't be able to go to Facebook and Twitter without the usual software they use in order to bypass the state-imposed filters that block these websites from being accessible here in Iran.
So there's still kind of censorship, even though the actual technology is advancing.
Absolutely. And that is, I guess, the flip side of this deal is that Iran, throughout decades, I must say, has had to deal with many new technologies. For instance, the satellite TV, mass medium, uncontrollable for those in power here. And, well, the solution has been now that satellite TV is still illegal, even though a lot of people have satellite dishes on their roofs. And then, of course, came the internet, you know, the highway of information at the fingertips of every Iranian youth. It was a nightmare for Iran's leaders. And what they have done is impose a very elaborate filtering system comparable to that of China. Now, mobile internet is on its way. And of course, they are doing the same. New technologies here are embraced, but only if the Iran's leaders can control them. And this is what they're doing with the filtering, which will also take place for the mobile internet.
You know, despite the clerics in Iran keeping the censorship there, it does feel like this is an advance. What do you think it all means?
Behind this is a struggle in Iran's leadership. There is a continuing struggle between those who feel that it's better to return to the time of the Prophet and those who feel that it's better to adapt Islam to modern day and age. And President Rouhani has been promoting the increase of internet speed and has been promoting the idea of having real grown-up mobile internet in Iran. And the fact that he has been successful, he's been able to give out his licenses, and nobody has stopped him until now, means that this change might not be turned back by the more conservative clerics. But of course, we'd have to wait and see.
Why do you think now? Is it just a Rouhani kind of thing?
I think that either he managed to trick his opponents because they just don't understand what 3G or 4G is, and they will wake up in a couple of months and decide to just take down the entire system again. But I also think that Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is a big supporter of science and technology. And I think that he signed off on this. But they will make sure that Twitter, Facebook, and of course, pornographic sites will not be accessible on the official internet.
So for people who have actually been able to get on, have you heard any reaction from them? Are they pretty excited?
Well, definitely, because the real revolution until now has taken place at the internet at home. Before, nobody in Iran was able to watch videos, at least the ones who didn't have like a ninja-like patience and determination in order to watch those videos, because they would just come in very, very, very slowly. But this has all changed. And for instance, my wife, who is a big fan of Facebook and an Iranian, spends now all her evenings on Facebook watching videos of cats and dogs and ISIS and other horrible things. No, but across the city, people have started to watch videos and make videos, and this is a big change.
New York Times reporter Thomas Erdbrink in Tehran speaking with us over a fast internet connection.
Thank you.
Coming up, a British-Iranian writer tells us why Tehran residents have to lead double lives. And going back to 3G and 4G for a moment, next time you're staring at your handheld device, stop by and see us on Instagram. The World posts fun behind-the-scenes photos from our reporters in the field. Follow us at Instagram.com/PRI the World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Iran's capital, Tehran, doesn't exactly have a good rap here in the West. I say Tehran, many will think angry Ayatollahs, black chadors, crowds chanting death to America. But think again, says Iranian author Ramita Navai. Tehran is also home to crystal meth, skinny jeans, and outrage bloggers. Navai explores that less visible side of Tehran in her new book, City of Lies. In it, she introduces us to a handful of residents. They're composite characters because sharing personal details with a reporter is still a very risky business in Tehran. The book starts with the story of a man Navai calls Dariush. She describes him as a 20-something who leads a comfortable life in the U.S. to join the underground opposition in Iran.
He really began by thinking that they were a bunch of crazies and that it was a cult organization. But they really got under his skin. They really managed to impress him, draw him in. So initially it was because of love, but then he did feel ideologically bound to them. And he got sped up the ranks really quickly. And that's when he was chosen for his mission to assassinate the chief of police.
Yeah, what happens when he tries to do that?
Well, it's just a comedy of errors. When he was telling me, the real man whose story this is based on was telling me what had happened to him, I was doubled over laughing. I mean, it's an assassination attempt, but it goes horribly wrong. So first of all, he flies to Tehran, realizes that he's been given really old intelligence. All the maps he's been given are completely old. He realizes he's going to have to stay there much longer than he originally anticipated, which means his mission is going to be much more dangerous. He's really badly equipped. Finally, when he attempts to kill the police chief, he gets caught. He's just really unlucky. When he gets caught, he was given a cyanide pill that he was lodged between his teeth and his gum. And he cracks the cyanide pill. And after about 30 seconds, they said he'd be dead in 30 seconds. And they said, whatever happens, if they catch you, you must kill yourself. You'll be horribly tortured. Of course, he's still alive. And the cyanide pill is old. The cyanide has gone off. They take him to the police station. They don't check him. The Iranian police didn't check his body. And he had a hand grenade, tucked in his trousers. He then attempts to blow himself up. And of course, he gets that wrong as well. And he just ends up blowing up his hand. So he now has a plastic hand.
It's a tragedy of errors. Contrast his story with that of Layla. She's this beautiful working class woman with few options. What's her story?
So Layla ends up working as a prostitute, and it begins as working as a lap dancer. She's fallen out with her family. She has no money. And she turns to prostitution. And prostitution in Iran is a big problem. I think official figures on the number of prostitutes in Tehran, about 300,000, but that's considered to be a real underestimate. Because Layla is exceptionally beautiful, she really did make it as a prostitute. So she started off working the streets, but then she quickly was catapulted to North Tehran, to the Playboy rich set. And she started making sex videos.
Layla's story, like Dariush, is also tragic. What happens to her when she tries to escape to Dubai?
So this is the composite character. In the book, when Layla tries to escape, she's caught. And her porn video, the sex film that she had made, had ended up in the hands of the police. And they had been trying to track her down. And in the background, there was an electricity meter. And that's how they managed to find her, was through her electricity meter reading. And she is hanged.
So, like you said, I mean, these are composite characters. Layla is based on more than one prostitute. I mean, it poses some problems for the reader. You say everything you've written is true, but details are compromised.
Where I did use composite characters, I made sure that every single detail that was told to me in an interview was not changed, unless it was a location that identified them. The real case of Layla, for example, the woman was caught through electricity meter reading. She was caught because her sex video had fallen in the hands of the police. And she was actually stoned in Evin prison. She was stoned to death.
You know, we tend to see Tehran in black and white, you know, black chadors, white minarets. Why don't you think we see in the West what's modern, you know, what you're writing about, the crystal meth dealers, the skinny jeans, the underground bloggers? Why do you think the presentation of Iran tends to be just so elementary?
I think part of the problem is that the regime does not want outsiders to see Iran in all its glory and all its color. And it has social problems. And the regime wants to hide some of the social problems. Having said that, the regime can also be quite liberal about some of its problems. So, for example, the regime has got quite liberal attitudes to drug rehabilitation. There are crystal meth drug rehab centers. There are needle exchange centers, methadone centers. Condoms are given out to prostitutes. So it's such a complex society. And I think for me, that's what makes it so exciting. And that's what I wanted the reader to see was this, the underbelly of the city that outsiders rarely get to see.
This need, and I think we can say need, that you describe on the part of Tehran residents to lie. As more and more people grow up in a country where the fundamentalist rules seem, you know, just out of step with the rest of the world, they hear about and see on the internet. Do you think the lies are just going to continue to grow?
I think something is changing within society, and it has a lot to do with youth culture and the fact that such a big percentage of the population is young there. I think they are striving to live a life that's more true to themselves. I think you can see this in a real sexual awakening that's happening in Tehran that I've seen spans all social classes. Of course, you know, young people do have to lie and lie about their sexuality in order to protect themselves either from being judged in society or from the regime. So, for example, if you're a woman, you still are expected to be a virgin before you get married, or if you are gay, it's still pretty unacceptable and there are dire consequences if the regime catches you. However, I do notice that young people are kind of are behaving in a freer way as regards sex and as regards relating to each other. And I think this will have a trickle-down effect. And I think this will mean, hopefully, maybe I'm being optimistic, but fewer lies.
Mm. Have you ever had to lie in Tehran yourself?
Yes, everybody has to lie. You lie about going to parties. You lie about alcohol being consumed at parties. You have to lie about certain people that you may see and you may hang out with. I met many office workers, actually, civil servants, for example, who in the office would pray. But they actually were pretending to pray. They didn't know a word of the Quran and they were mumbling gobbledygook under their breath. But they did this because it would help them get a promotion. It would make them look good in the office. So that as well is a form of lying and not being true to yourself. But actually, I see the fact that Iranians lie as a very positive thing because they are so obsessed with being true to themselves. You know, it's really part of our culture. It's in all our poetry. It's in our literature that they are intent on living the lives they want to live, even if that means that they have to lie to do so. They're really adaptable people.
Journalist Ramita Navai, her new book is City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death, and the Search for Truth in Tehran. Great to meet you, Ramita. Thank you.
Thank you.
News headlines are next on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the world, fighting Ebola in Sierra Leone and screening for it here in the U.S., plus a high-stakes global chess tournament in St. Louis.
We have the world chess champion, we have the number one American player, and of the six players that are participating, they're all in the top 10 in the world. So it's very exciting for everybody here in St. Louis.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World from PRI. When there's an emergency, you know you can call 911 and get a very quick response, a response that saves lives. We also expect quick and robust responses when disaster strikes around the globe. Think of all those international medical teams rushing to the Philippines last year after Typhoon Yolanda. But the reaction to the current Ebola outbreak in West Africa? How about anything but quick? Doctor and reporter Sherry Fink has an article in today's New York Times about the slow response to this Ebola crisis. She joins us now. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, Marco.
Good to have you on the program, as always. And before we even talk about the response, I want to play this incredible piece of tape from Sierra Leone. This is an audio diary entry by Oliver Johnson. He's a British doctor treating Ebola patients there. Let's have a listen.
As a doctor helping to run the main isolation unit at the referral hospital in Freetown, the day starts with phone calls, maybe 3, 4, 5 a.m. from the nurses in the unit calling us to tell us about the patients who have died overnight. And as we arrive in at about 8 a.m., we start what will be the first of many occasions of getting suited up in this full protective gear, the suit, the goggles, the mask, the shoes, the gloves, to go inside to see what lies for us on the new day. Often, at least one or two patients, sometimes three, four, five patients will have died in the night. Often they get out of their beds before they die, they're down on the floor. And the process starts with cleaning the bodies, decontaminating, getting body bags ready, and then trying to clean the rest of the unit, cleaning up the beds, to get ready for the new patients that we know are going to come streaming in throughout the day. We do everything we can to get burial teams out to move the bodies, and we brace ourselves for patients coming in, either from our A&E department or ambulances that come through the main gates of the hospital without warning, and we never know what we'll find inside. We're lucky it's one patient, but often four up to seven patients might be inside this ambulance, whole families that have become sick. As we work to straighten the patients out, to isolate them, waiting for the surveillance officers to come to find out who have they been in contact with, who needs to be traced, which houses need to be quarantined, we also face what was yesterday a motorbike turning up right next to the ambulance with an unconscious patient who was bleeding, confused, hard to rouse. His brother holding him on the motorbike, sprayed with his blood as they're driven along, blood covering his face and shoulder. As you see these patients now, you know that they're going to be Ebola positive, but you also see the families that bring them in, and you know how much contamination has already happened and how hard it will be to control. Even after going home, after a long day at work, I was soon called back last night to hear the news that a senior nurse in our triage unit, a wonderful friend and colleague, Sister Hajara Seri, had died of Ebola, having contracted it a couple of weeks before. This news is devastating for the whole hospital and creates more fear in the heart of the health workers here. So every day things are getting harder out here in Freetown. There's a constant risk we're going to be overwhelmed, and we just hope that more help's going to come soon to try and keep this outbreak from expanding even further.
That's Oliver Johnson, a British doctor treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone. Sherry Fink, you've been writing about the slow response to Ebola in the New York Times. What strikes you about what we just heard?
Well, it really brings you right into a little sliver of what it's like to be facing this challenge. And many of the doctors I've spoken with, like this doctor, are so frustrated because they're so overwhelmed, they're so understaffed that they're providing just the most basic care possible. And everybody who's been involved in caring for patients with Ebola feels that if they can do a little more for them, just basic supportive care, they can save more lives. And then those people become ambassadors back to their communities, being able to say, you know, I survived. And so therefore, it is worthwhile for you to go and be isolated and be treated in one of these treatment centers. But it's just like the whole system is just failing on every level.
Well, there are some people helping, like that doctor we just heard from, Oliver Johnson, and a few countries have sent doctor teams to help treat Ebola patients, but surprisingly, very few. What countries have sent teams?
Very few. So the way that the WHO, the World Health Organization, tends to work, and now, you know, there's a lot of questions about whether this is enough, but one of the main things they do is try to marshal people from other organizations, foreign medical teams, which are now kind of formalized, they register. And Bruce Alward, who's the head of emergency response for earthquakes, wars, et cetera, at the WHO, has been asked to step in and help with Ebola. And he just said, you know, there were just so many, I can't remember if it was in the hundreds of foreign medical teams that were eager to run in and help after, for example, the typhoon in the Philippines recently. And he said, I put out the call this time to all of these countries. I said, send us your medical units that you love to send into disasters. Mm. And they said, you know, sure, this is really important. And then no phone call back. And he said, months later, no one's responded. Well, since then, I've learned a couple countries have. I was told by somebody else at the WHO that Cuba has a team. China has sent some people in. Uganda, which has obviously a lot of experience with Ebola. But in terms of these foreign medical teams, we don't see a lot of them coming. And the answer is fear. Margaret Chan herself, who I interviewed on Monday.
She's the head of WHO.
Yes, the head of WHO said this is the hardest outbreak she has ever been involved in fighting. And she goes back to SARS in Hong Kong when she was director there. She said it's just the fear. There's no medicine for fear.
Did she experience any pushback or reluctance from doctors around the world to get involved in the SARS outbreak in 2003?
She emphasized that that outbreak occurred in countries that had better abilities to handle it on their own. So in the countries that are most affected here, just have very few doctors, very few nurses to begin with. And in some of the hospitals right at the center of the outbreak, when it began in Guinea, some of the doctors who worked there said there was no running water. How do you even do basic infection control? So these countries need the aid from outside.
So what about the United States and the Centers for Disease Control? Are they on the ground and what are they doing?
Well, yes, they are. They've sent, last time I checked, it was some 70 people out. But the CDC's role is more in the epidemiology, you know, sort of like trying to understand where people are getting infected and trying to bring that under control. As for the clinical side, my understanding is that they're not getting involved in that. And I did reach out to the Department of Health and Human Services, which runs the National Medical Disaster Response System in the U.S., which is what we use in our own country when there are disasters. But there's a part of that that goes to foreign disasters like earthquakes. And I asked whether they were sending any of these teams. They actually have the ability to set up a tented field hospital. And they said that there were no current plans to send those teams in to treat Ebola.
The WHO has stated that this Ebola outbreak could lead to 20,000 fatalities. So why does it not have some kind of rapid response team to address that that projection?
Well, I've heard even some scientists projecting that that could be a very modest estimate if more is not done to contain the outbreak. You know, there are a lot of people pushing the WHO to do more, and they're pushing back and saying it's not our role. We're primarily a technical agency. We're there to give advice. And I think that people are saying, you know, that's not enough. You do have, by your constitution, a role in leading outbreak response. They do have a Department of Emergencies, and they do rapidly deploy, and they did send people right away. But what is missing is this sort of command responsibility. I think that is the key. So when I talk to people who attend meetings, for example, that the WHO and the ministries of health run every day, they say, you know, it's informational. People are checking in. They're saying, this is what's happening here, there. But there's nobody who's sort of in command saying, okay, now you go out to do this, you go out to do that, with a kind of overview of what's happening and what needs to happen to bring this under control. So it's not just that they lack the manpower, but it also has to do with just the very structure by which and the sort of the frame that they look at in terms of their role. And it's not been a role of taking command. And some people are saying we need that. You know, in the U.S. now, we have this incident command system across levels of government, across companies when there's an emergency. And it is sort of very clear roles for people to fill. You know, that's another difference from when there are these humanitarian emergencies. Because over the years, there was exactly the same kind of thing, this confusion over roles, this lack of coordination. It's still a problem. But over the years, there's been a structure that's agreed upon by the different non-governmental charities, as well as the UN system. And my understanding is that it's not really laid out for outbreaks. And we're only now shifting into the humanitarian mindset here, as we see quarantined areas needing food aid, as we see the entire medical systems shutting down in the areas where Ebola is active, because, as we heard, nurses are dying, doctors.
I mean, since Doctors Without Borders is the biggest presence in a lot of these stricken countries, could they just kind of take an executive decision and say, we're going to take charge now?
Well, they have taken some executive decisions, and they have made a lot of decisions on their own. But their mandate, their mission is to treat patients. And they're already way overwhelmed with that. And talk about the WHO having trouble recruiting people to go work in the Ebola affected areas. Doctors Without Borders has had a bit of problem too, recruiting enough people to go to all of these places that need help. You know, the difference with the WHO has this internationally agreed upon mandate, 190 some countries that have given it the legal authority to lead in the case of international emergencies and global health issues. They have a mandate that a charity doesn't have.
Physician and reporter Sherry Fink, her latest article for the New York Times is about the WHO's less than rapid response to the Ebola outbreak. Sherry, thank you as always.
Thanks, Marco.
One more note on Ebola now. As we've heard, one key to keeping the disease from spreading is screening. And that's happening not just in West Africa, but on college campuses right here in the United States. About 10,000 students from Nigeria, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea attend American universities. And of course, students are just starting a new academic year right now. Alma Olson heads Student Health Services at the University of Akron in Ohio. What screening measures have you put in place there?
Well, when we first started to look at Ebola and how it would affect our campus, you know, knowing that we had international students from these countries, I spoke with the Summit County Health Department, Dr. Margot Ermey here in Akron, Ohio, to discuss what she felt about this, knowing that she keeps very close to CDC guidelines. And she advised that we needed to be cautious, definitely cautious, but we did not need to be in a crisis state. She suggested that we look at screening for the students that we had coming back from those countries just to make sure they weren't in a high-risk situation. So using CDC guidelines, we came up with a questionnaire to find out when they left their country, which is very important because of the incubation period. Were there any exposure to any body fluids by somebody who was known to have Ebola virus? We do have some that do some humanitarian work, so we were concerned about that. So we give them this questionnaire when they reached our campus.
And how many students do you have from affected countries in West Africa?
We have 7 graduate students that we knew of from the countries that were identified as problematic, and we had approximately 15 undergraduate students that we were able to reach during their orientation on campus.
Are you taking any temperature readings?
We are. They were asked to come to health services as soon as they got our message, which they have done. At that time, we take their temperature. We give them the questionnaire. Depending on the answers, we would know whether they were high risk. Thus far, everybody that we have screened has been low risk. And then we provided them with disposable thermometers, and they were to watch their temperature on a daily basis and to call us if they had any increase in temperature. What we told them was really problematic was anything over 101.5, but we also told them that even if they reached over 100, that we probably should be contacted.
So how do you actually strike that sensitive balance between caution and alarm? In my mind, I see like a student from Guinea with his American roommate wondering, where are you off to health services so quickly after arriving on campus?
Yeah, I understand what you're asking. And surprisingly so, we have not had a lot of that sort of reaction on campus. And actually, most of our international students do not live in the residence halls, we found. We feel that because we were being proactive and not reactive, it would give a sense of comfort to anybody that was involved with these international students. We were more concerned of how the international students would take it that we were monitoring them.
Yeah, how are they taking it? How have they responded?
We haven't even had anybody really concerned. They seem to be just fine with our concern, and they understood our concern. We did get one response where somebody did mention that they live at least 17 hours from any area in their country that was at risk. Mm. But, you know, we assured them that we were screening everybody from those countries, and we had a very low suspicion of any risk. And I think we've been able to put out that out to the campus community.
Do you have emergency plans in place in the event that you have a suspected Ebola case?
We have advised the students that are at risk that what they should do is monitor their temperature. We ask them to call us, not to come up here, because we're not equipped to really handle the situation as far as, you know, the protection that we would need for the clinic and for ourselves. We have our hospital very close to here in Akron, Ohio, that we would then refer them to.
Ms. Olson, just as a talking point on campus at the start of the new year, is Ebola on people's minds?
That is, you know, obviously it is on anybody's mind that I have dealt with, such as student affairs, because I'm part of the student affairs division. As far as students are concerned, I don't think so.
Right. You think they're talking more about the leak of nude celebrity photos from Hollywood?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something like that. I think that we have not gotten a lot of concern, and I think we would have. I mean, when mumps was the thing last year, I got a lot of calls from parents that seemed more concerned about that. I have not gotten calls from parents at all.
Alma Olson heads Student Health Services at the University of Akron in Ohio. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
You're tuned to The World on PRI, Public Radio International, and on PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The eyes of the chess world are on St. Louis, Missouri. That's right, the city best known to most of us for baseball, and Budweiser is currently hosting what organizers say is the strongest tournament in the history of chess ever. It's called the Sinkfield Cup, and according to chess insiders, this tournament really is worthy of the hype. I asked Ben Feingold, a grandmaster from St. Louis, to give us the lowdown.
This is the strongest chess tournament of all time, actually. It's the highest rated. We have the world chess champion. We have the number one American player. And of the six players that are participating, they're all in the top 10 in the world. So it's very exciting for everybody here in St. Louis.
And among those is the LeBron James of chess, a guy named Magnus Carlsen of Norway. How old is he and what makes him so good?
Boy, I wish I knew what made him so good so that I could do it. he's 23 years old, and I think he turns 24 later in the year. What makes him so good? He actually has quite a different style than a lot of the other world-class players. He doesn't like to have a lot of preparation for his game where he's basically trying to memorize more than his opponent. He's trying to make the game go its own way very early and then outplay his opponent with his superior skill. So a lot of the times early in the game, we see positions we haven't seen before, and somehow Magnus seems to play those positions better than other grandmasters. And I think for the most part, the top players in the world like to have, one-third or half of the game memorized before they play it, so they feel very comfortable. And Magnus takes them out of their comfort zone, and he's very skilled at doing that.
And he's not some frumpy nerd in a cardigan, is he? He's got swagger, this guy.
No, he's, he actually likes sports quite a bit. And even during a tournament, you can see him playing golf or tennis or basketball or jogging. And he's a fashion model. He's on television. He's a world traveler. He's played chess with Bill Gates. the guy's a real go-getter.
Funnily, he's not the main story coming out of St. Louis. The big news is about the play of a young Italian chess master named Fabiano Caruana. What's he doing?
Actually, he's an Italian-American. He was born in America and lived here until he was about 12 or 13. And he moved to Europe basically to improve his chess and play in a lot of strong European events. He's been, I'd say in the last year or two, one of the top 5 or 10 players in the world. But this is like his coming out tournament. He's having what I would consider the greatest tournament in history. And clearly, everybody agrees it's a big shock. He's 6 out of 6, which is at this level is unheard of. And it's very surprising, not only to the players who are watching, but to Fabiano himself. So it's very exciting that we not only have the world's strongest player, Magnus Carlsen, but we have somebody who's doing what has never been done before, winning all of their games at a level where at least half the games are draws because the players are so strong. So to not lose a game and to not draw a game at this point is just phenomenal.
And 6 wins in a row, that's not typical, I gather.
Maybe once every 20 or 30 years it happens. And especially this is the strongest tournament of all time. If you told me that somebody had 6 wins in a row to start, even if it was Magnus, there's basically a less than 0.01% chance that would happen. So we're all mystified at what's going on. And it's not like his opponents are giving him the wins. He's just playing fantastic this tournament. So this is going to be really exciting, not only for him, but for the chess world to see if he can pretty soon challenge Magnus for the crown.
Wow. Could this revive, the classic trope of Karpov and Kasparov rivalry?
I think so, because, lately there's been like Magnus, and he's clearly the best player in the world. But now that he has a big competitor, and also somebody who's a very interesting person in his own right, he's very modest, very well-spoken, and he's really well-liked by not only the spectators, the other players like him as well. So some of the players can be off-putting, and they're very competitive, and sometimes there were big arguments in the Karpov-Kasparov era. But these players are a little bit more friendly and very spectator-friendly. So it's really great for everybody that these are the two best players in the world right now, and we could see a great rivalry coming up soon.
Have you had the chance as a grandmaster to play either Caruana or Carlsen?
Well, it's funny. I haven't played these players lately. I did play Fabiano in Philadelphia about 10 years ago when he was a young master, and I ended up winning the game. But basically, the top players in the world are mainly playing against each other. And I'm a grandmaster, but I'm not one of the world's best grandmasters. So it's very unlikely that I would face them in competition. So you got to beat them when they're young. A lot of these grandmasters played a lot of chess when they were beginners and upcoming. So that's when you're supposed to beat them. And then you could just watch them and be in awe later in their careers.
You know, Ben, I noticed a couple of times during this interview, you mentioned kind of the history-making quality of what's happening there in St. Louis. When it's all over, do you think history will be made?
Yeah, I mean, it's very unlikely that Fabiano will go 10-0. That would still be crazy. So I think it is going to be history-making in the fact that we're going to see two players, Magnus and Fabiano, like fighting and jockeying for first position. And I think we're going to see a world championship match in the future.
Wow. St. Louis making chess sexy. Is Red Bull interested in sponsoring chess yet?
Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. Red Bull is currently sponsoring one of the players in this tournament, Nakamura, the top American player.
Right.
And he actually wore a Red Bull jersey, and he's drinking Red Bull during his games. Hasn't worked out for him so far, but there's four rounds to go. So, yeah, you hit the sponsor on the nose. Very good.
Well, I had to ask. Who knew? Ben Feingold, the chess grandmaster from St. Louis. Good luck with the tournament.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, full disclosure here. I spoke with Ben yesterday, and since then, Fabiano Caruana extended his win streak to record 7 straight victories. And today it's Caruana versus world number one Magnus Carlsen. They were still battling it out as we went to air, but you might want to check that score later tonight. Finally, visitors to Boston's Franklin Park Zoo got a special treat today. They got to meet Maya. She's the ocelot kitten we told you about back in July. You see, Maya is the daughter of Isidoro, the Brazilian wildcat who helped us predict the outcome of World Cup games this summer. And the name Maya, well, she was chosen by one of you, Laura Thompson from Pasadena, California, who listens to The World on station KPCC.
I suggested Maya for the kitten because Maya's my daughter's name. She's 9 years old, and she is an avid big cat, all cat, wild cat aficionado.
Back in July, we called Laura to tell her Maya was selected as the new name for the baby ocelot.
I'm so happy for her, and I'm so happy for the kitten because Maya is a beautiful name, and it means mother of all creation, which is a great name for any cat.
We've posted an album from Maya's first public appearance on our Facebook page. Trust me, she is one cute little wild kitten. See for yourself at facebook.com/PRI the world. Okay, let's get baby Maya to sleep with a nice lullaby, shall we? And since this ocelot's pedigree is Brazilian, here's Babel Gilberto to serenade her. This is from Babel's just released CD Tudo and her cover of Neil Young's Harvest Moon. Yeah, it really does work. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman.
Come a little bit closer. Hear what I have to say. Just like children sleeping.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berkey and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.